The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're taking a look at the past, present, and future of food, and what science has to say about some popular health trends. I'm here with Marlene Zuck, a professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of Sex on Six Legs, and most recently, Paleo Fantasy. Welcome to the show, Marlene.
Thanks for having me.
So, what is a paleo fantasy exactly?
The anthropologist Leslie Aiello used the word a few years ago when she was talking about the way that people will construct notions about human brain evolution and the way we were a long time ago. And I really liked the term because I think it expresses what a lot of us think about what humans were like in our more distant past. So we all have fantasies about, you know, what it would have been like to have lived in the 1800s or what it would have been like to have been in, you know, medieval France or whatever. But there are also a lot of ideas about what people were like in whatever you want to think of as the Stone Age, whether that, and for some people, that's 10,000 years ago. For some people, that's 100,000 years ago. For some people, it's a million years ago. And part of that fuzziness becomes problematic, which is one of the things I talk about in the book. But the idea is that we have this image that, well, there were people who were living in the wilderness and they were perfectly adapted to their environment and their lives were a certain way. And that might apply to the way they ate or the way they moved around or the way they interacted with their children. And so in some ways, I don't even mean paleo fantasies to be necessarily all that pejorative, although I think you could interpret them that way. The idea is more that we have these notions about, oh, cavemen did this. And then along with that idea, and this is really what I got interested in with the book, is this notion that, well, therefore, that was when human beings were perfectly adapted. And so that's what we should be emulating in our modern lives.
Well, now, how does this manifest? What are you seeing in contemporary culture that's built on these ideas?
Almost any time somebody starts criticizing something about modern life, whether it's that we watch too much TV, or we're eating too many fatty foods, or we're spending too much time plugged into our electronic devices, or what have you, people will often use as a reference point, well, you know, we didn't evolve this way. We evolved, and then they come up with their paleo fantasy, the idea of what we evolved to be doing. And as an evolutionary biologist, I got interested in that not only because of the accuracy or not of those particular paleo fantasies. So it's not just whether or not we were eating a certain thing or whether or not we were or weren't running long distances. It's this idea that there was a time period in which human beings or any other organism evolved until they were perfectly adapted. And then, in the case of humans, modern life came along and swept us off that peak so that now we're just hopelessly mismatched with our environment. That concept writ large really reflects a misunderstanding of the way evolution works.
Well, and this is all built at least partially on the idea that evolution is always very, very slow, right?
Two things. One is that it's very slow. And so we think, okay, evolution is, you know, what happens when, you know, you go from having dinosaurs to having birds, or, you know, when you evolve legs or something like that, which takes millions and millions of years. So that's part of it. And then the other part is that evolution's moving toward a particular goal. And neither of those ideas are correct. Certainly evolution is sometimes slow, but it's also sometimes remarkably fast. And the second thing, the idea that evolution's got a goal or that we're progressing towards something, is just flat out wrong.
Well, your book makes the case for, I guess, occasional rapid evolution. Can you explain that?
Well, scientists are, at least some scientists, are kind of plumping for the idea that what we used to think of as unusual cases of rapid evolution are becoming more and more commonplace now that we know where to look. One of the best places to look, of course, is not in humans, but in a lot of the organisms that humans interact with. And I got interested in this whole idea. People sometimes wonder, well, why did you start writing a book that deals a lot with human evolution when the main part of your research is on insects and their sex lives, which I guess is a legitimate thing to wonder about. But in fact, for me, they're very closely connected because part of our research on crickets and their sex lives, it ended up with a discovery that, in fact, we'd observed really rapid evolution in the ability of male crickets to produce a calling song, which is cool for all kinds of reasons in behavior and in animal behavior and sexual selection. But it all happened within about 20 generations, which, of course, from the standpoint of the way most people think about evolution, is unbelievably rapid. And so then that got me thinking a lot about, well, what other cases of really rapid evolution do we have? And so I started doing a lot of reading. And of course, it turns out that there's lots and lots of instances where evolution happens in the classical definition is less than 100 generations is we'll consider that rapid. And there's lots and lots of cases where that's happened.
Well, how would we distinguish between like a rapid change due to selection and maybe other events that could suddenly cause change, something like a migration or an insect plague of some kind?
So remember, evolution and natural selection are not synonymous. Evolution can happen for a bunch of reasons. It can happen because of random factors, which we talk about genetic drift, which just means that there's, you know, random things that will happen often in small populations. So incidental things will have a big effect on the gene pool just because there aren't very many individuals that bear the genes. But that's still evolution, even if there hasn't been selection. And just like you said, migration can result in evolution because you're seeing a change in the gene pool of the population, which classically is what you need to have happen. Selection certainly can also happen, and that can result in rapid change, which is what I think happened with the crickets and what's happened, at least in some cases, with humans as well. But I think that this other point that selection and evolution are not synonymous is something that gets overlooked by people as well.
But then how would we distinguish between the two?
There's several things you can do. One of them is that if you know the selection pressure and you can demonstrate that a change has occurred in a population that's in response to that selection, then it's pretty easy to see. And we know that in the case of, say, finches in the Galapagos, where the bill sizes change over very short periods, and the bills that are in the individuals that remained after a drought or after some other climatic event are better suited to eat the seeds that are still around. And so we can tell that that's selection. In humans, you can also look directly, and in some other organisms, depending on whether their genome's been sequenced, you can also look more or less directly at the genes. And so I keep telling people this is one of the reasons this is a really fun time to study evolution, is that we now have genomic tools that let us look directly at the genes and see what are called signatures of selection. So you can observe genetic changes on the chromosome where you say, huh, it looks like that area of the chromosome has changed relatively recently in comparison with other areas. And then if you know what those genes are doing, you can make conclusions about how rapidly changes happen. But it's just extraordinary what we're able to do that we couldn't accomplish even 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
And you say that we've seen this with our ability to digest milk.
Yeah. So kind of, I always tell people the poster child for rapid evolution in humans is lactase persistence. People, of course, we'll point out to you that humans are the only mammal that drink milk or consume dairy past the point of weaning. And that's absolutely true. But the reason that humans can do that is not because we're living in a strange age with, you know, Frankenfoods that have been modified and we're doing things that are wreaking havoc on our bodies. It's because our genes have changed. They've evolved. And in what's a really amazing example of genes affecting culture, which then affect genes, which then affect culture. Cattle herders, maybe 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, who were able to keep cattle not just for meat, but also were able to consume the milk, were at an advantage. Those people who had gene variants allowing them to digest dairy, and you know, there's always going to be variation around because that's the raw material that evolution can act on. So there's always variation. Well, some of the people were able to digest milk just through happenstance. Those people survived and reproduced better. And then their genes were disproportionately left in the population. And then after a few thousand years, we had a preponderance of genes that could break down lactose, the sugar in milk, in the population as a whole. And that, of course, was feeding back on keeping cattle, because if cattle become more useful to you, you're going to be able to keep them more. And if you're going to be able to keep them more, then that's stronger selection on the ability of people to digest dairy, and back and forth it goes. And demonstrably, this happened in 5,000 to 7,000 years in people that are herding cattle. Now, all people can't digest dairy because not all people are descended from cattle herders.
Is the idea that we rapidly evolved, I guess, to consume lactose widely accepted at this point, or is there a debate around this?
Oh, yeah. No, the idea that we evolved to do this is pretty widely accepted. There are a few other ideas that were tossed around, but my understanding certainly is that this is the poster child for rapid evolution, because the genes are really pretty well nailed down. There's always more details you can find out, and there's always more cool stuff happening in a finer scale that you can look at. What's really interesting is that although there are genes that allow you to break down lactose, in different parts of the world, those genes are different. So Africans who can digest dairy and who are descended from cattle herding people have a different form of a gene that allows you to break down lactose than descendants of Northern Europeans, which I just think is really cool.
What about the idea of rapid evolution on the whole? How contentious is that?
That's one of the points of my book, is that it's really hard to talk about evolution of the whole, because we're sort of this jigsaw puzzle of parts that are not all being selected like a group. I mean, certainly all of our genes occur in an organism, and you can't just pull out one and pluck it out and stick it in somebody else. But there can be selection on part of the genome that then has bad effects in another part of the genome. And so our bodies and the way our biology works is full of trade-offs and compromises and things that are okay under some circumstances and not okay in others, and things that work well in the beginning of life and not so much at the end of life, and so forth. So you can't just say, oh, everything has evolved really quickly, because it doesn't all evolve at the same rate.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by Marlene Zuk, professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior, and the author of Paleo Fantasy. Okay, so that lactose research happens to run entirely contrary to what proponents of the paleo diet tell us. So maybe give us some background on the paleo diet first.
There are a lot of people who feel like it would be much better for humans if we tried to eat a diet that was more like what our early ancestors were eating. And at least when I started looking at it, there's lots and lots of different versions of this. Some people think that we should be eating solely meat with almost no plant material. Some people think it's okay to have plant material as long as you don't have processed grains, and so on and so forth. But again, the idea is, you know, that we could be emulating diets from the distant past. And while certainly a lot of the elements of the diet, and I always tell people that, you know, I'm really not trying to tell people what they should eat. I'm not interested in what people should eat, you know, not writing a diet book, not a dietitian, just not really what I'm trying to do here. And I know that people get really passionate about their diets, and you know, everybody's got their fringe thing. So that's kind of the obligatory caveat. But having said that, what interested me about it was starting to think about, well, okay, if you did want to eat like people ate 100,000 years ago, could you do that? What would it look like? And the answer to that turns out to be surprisingly complicated. I mean, part of it is, well, would you pick 100,000 years? Would it be better to pick 20,000 years? It kind of makes a difference, because people spread around the globe in different ways and at different times. So that's one complication. Do you want to pick people who were living in Africa? Do you want to pick people who had moved into North America or Europe? Do you want to look at the Inuit in, you know, far north Canada? You know, how exactly is this going to work? And then which one of their diets do you want to pick? Because human beings turn out to be able to eat a pretty wide variety of foods.
Actually, you looked at this in a really interesting way. You looked at it from a number of angles. So what does the fossil record tell us about the paleo diet then?
A few years ago, there was a huge amount of press about something that, if you think about it, kind of dispassionately sounds like a completely trivial, boring result, which is that it turns out that Neanderthals, as well as some other early humans, actually were processing, at least in a crude sense, by grinding up seeds of a plant that resembles a cattail and baking it into what, I don't know who came up with this phrase, but then all the media picked it up. They called it a crude form of pita. I'm not sure what a crude form of pita is as opposed to like a refined form of pita, but they called it a crude, everybody called it a crude form of pita. And that, you know, early humans were eating this. And so, oh gosh, this seemed to suggest that human beings were eating starch, which is anathema to at least some forms of what people interpret as a paleo diet, because the idea was that, oh, people were relying mostly on meat. But what it really revealed to me, I think, is again that people's diets were variable and people took advantage of lots of different sorts of food. What's interesting and what seemed to have gotten neglected in a lot of that is the idea of, you know, how did people learn to do all this various food preparation in ways that made things more digestible, which is, I think, an interesting question that kind of gets neglected in the zeal to figure out what the one thing that everybody was eating might have been. So, you know, you can look at the fossil record. Another place that people sometimes look is at contemporary foraging peoples and, you know, saying, okay, well, what do they eat and what proportion of their diet is comprised of, or is composed of plant material as opposed to animals and, you know, so on and so forth. A difficulty in trying to emulate those, though, is that, of course, we don't really have access to a lot of those kinds of foods. So even, you know, grass-fed beef is not going to be all that similar to eating a woolly mammoth.
Right.
Game animals are arguably more similar to, you know, what people would have been eating than other forms of, you know, factory-farmed meat. But, you know, when you start parsing this, it gets really, you know, it's one of these things where the devil really is in the details. And even with plant foods, if you say, well, it's okay to eat some plant foods as long as you're not eating too much processed grain, well, all of the fruits and vegetables we have are really modified from the ancestors. You know, this is what agriculture's done for us. The ancestor of corn is teosinte, this, you know, it looks like a grass head, which is basically what it is. And it really doesn't resemble modern corn at all. Or if you don't like corn, well, the ancestor of apples is not going to get you any prizes either.
Well, what about genetics? You mentioned, you know, the milk digestion gene. So might there be other digestion genes?
Yeah, there's some evidence that humans do have more copies of amylase genes, which is the enzyme you use to break down starch. And so if you have more of a starch-based diet, you tend to have more copies of the peoples of the world that have a more starch-based diet will tend to have more copies of an amylase gene. And so I really think it's much more important that this change is continuous. So it's not like, again, you know, we were all eating one way and we were perfectly suited to that. And then suddenly changes happened and we had to have this big wrenching difference to make us able to digest a new food. Things are happening much more in fits and starts and much more gradually. And I think it just doesn't seem in keeping with the way we understand evolution to imagine that there was this time of perfect harmony, because you can always go further back. I mean, you can imagine being someone, you know, in whatever you want to interpret caveman times as, living there, and, you know, we were supposedly descended from animals that would scavenge food rather than hunt it, or at least rely a lot more on scavenged food. I mean, were they feeling nostalgic for the fact that, well, you know, what's this business of hunting the food yourself? It's always really bloody. It's kind of nasty. Isn't it better to just find something that's already nice and decently dead and we should, you know, and has already started rotting and that's probably better for us? And what is with this newfangled thing? We're not really suited to it. You know, and you can, I mean, I realize I'm exaggerating to make a point, but really, 'twas ever thus. Evolution is continuous. You're not just stopping at a point and going, phew, that's over with. Now we can turn our minds to other things and watch television.
Well, you did write that there might be some relationship to where people live and their ability to metabolize food. And yes, you also wrote that's a very new branch of science, but it's interesting.
Yeah. And so again, with these modern genomic tools, what we can do is look very closely at variation across the globe in what kind of genes people have and who they're descended from. And then you can start looking at all kinds of things, not just diet, but, you know, disease resistance. Are there genes for resisting diseases that were prevalent in certain parts of the world that you would find, you know, you would imagine that you'd find those genes in people that are descended from people from those parts of the world and so forth. And so it's literally like being able to read a signature of something that was written in the past in that we're all carrying around in our bodies.
So then in terms of diet, are you basically saying that we just don't know enough about how our ancestors ate, and especially you couldn't apply that even if you did to our current eating habits?
It actually seems perfectly reasonable to me to start from first principles and say, huh, here are a bunch of people in North America who seem like they're overweight or obese, they've got diabetes, they've got hypertension, they seem like they're having a lot of problems related to what they're eating that people sometime in the past, whatever period you want to pick, didn't seem to have. So can we figure out what was better about the way people used to eat? And then, and here's the crucial then, do some science to figure out whether those ideas are actually accurate about what will result in a better diet. So saying, okay, I'm sure that because people didn't eat, you know, grain 20,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago, therefore grain is bad for you, seems much less productive as a way to think about this than to say, huh, I wonder if thing X would be something that would be bad for you, or I wonder if thing Y. A lot of the recent interest in the Mediterranean diet, for instance, suggests that that might be a very healthy diet for people. And that work is based on evidence that people are collecting, looking at, well, if you eat this diet, you end up with that result. If you eat a different diet, you end up with another result. I don't think you could ever emulate perfectly a diet from, you know, 15 or 100,000 years ago, because those foods aren't available anymore. And it's not clear that being that extreme would do you any good. But I think using this as an inspiration and then saying, all right, so now we need to collect data is the way to go, rather than, oh, well, I'm not going to eat dairy because people weren't eating dairy 100,000 years ago. I mean, that would be like saying, I'm not going to become bipedal because my ancestors were not bipedal. Bipedal is bad. You know, and actually, arguably, there would be some support for that. Being bipedal is not great. You know, it causes problems with childbirth. You know, we have back problems. You know, putting what was essentially a quadruped skeleton on two legs is, you got problems. But it's what ended up happening. And there's just no point saying, oh, we would just all be better off trying to run around on all fours.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll get back to our conversation with Marlene Zuk, author of Paleo Fantasy, right after these messages.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest is Marlene Zuk, a professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior at the University of Minnesota, and the author of Paleo Fantasy. There's another popular pastime that rests on an assumption that humans are, I guess, pushing themselves farther than evolution allows. Barefoot running. So what's this about?
Just like people are interested in what our early diets were like, because it just seems like eating Cheetos and Diet Coke is probably not the way we were eating for a long period in our history, people are interested in how much we should be moving around and what kind of exercise patterns seem like they would be most natural. And then the interest in running has led to a further interest in whether or not so-called extreme kinds of running like marathons were natural, or whether that's some weird modern thing that has happened to humans.
So why is barefoot running supposed to be better for you, I guess, according to barefoot runners?
Well, so there's two things in here. One of them is that if human beings were historically, ancestrally, however you want to put it, exercising by running, or if they, you know, not necessarily exercising, because I don't think anybody's arguing that there were, you know, Paleolithic gyms, but if they were running a lot in ancient times, we can be pretty darn sure they weren't wearing shoes. And so if they were running a lot, and they were barefoot, and that was natural, then maybe running barefoot now would be natural. And here's a good example of where you can take what you can call a paleo fantasy, or you can call it a paleo hypothesis if you want to, and then you start collecting data. And so there are a number of scientists who have started looking at what happens to the human gait if you run barefoot or with very minimal shoes. It turns out that, in fact, wearing shoes doesn't prevent the injuries that a lot of people assume that it does, and that a lot of people can run barefoot without it harming their bodies very much at all. The key is what your foot strike is like. So that, and I'm saying this, I'm not a runner myself, so I actually found all this literature really interesting, because I did not have, as they say, a dog in this hunt, because I was just reading all this stuff thinking, oh, okay, this is interesting. I have had no preconceived notions. And so the idea is that if you're running barefoot or with minimal shoes, you tend to strike with the forefoot, whereas if you're wearing heavily padded shoes, you tend to strike with the hind foot, your heel, you do heel strike, and that's not terribly good for you, in terms of potential injuries. So running barefoot looks like it might be better for your body than running with shoes, with this very important caveat, namely that you know how to do it right because you've been either trained or you've done it that way since you were very young. And that brings up a really interesting point, not just about running, but about every aspect of evolution, which is that traits never evolve in the absence of an environment. And so Greg Downey, who's an anthropologist at Macquarie University in Australia, and who's real interested in early forms of activity, as it were, and exercise and all that, pointed out that, look, imagine a little baby, and that little baby who can't even walk yet is either going to be put into shoes or not. Well, that baby's foot is going to be shaped literally by the shoe that you put on them. So, we know that wearing shoes will change the way your foot's appearance and the way it functions. And if you wear high heels a lot, for instance, it can have some really, bad effects on your Achilles tendon and so forth. But if you don't wear shoes and you're just walking on the ground, then that affects your foot shape too. And so you can't say, oh, there's some like ur foot that was the way that feet are supposed to be in the absence of an environment, because feet are just in an environment. And that's true for every other aspect of your physiology and the way people are, is that there's always this interplay between the way the environment affects you and then how your genetic composition affects how you interact with the environment. So the barefoot runners are certainly doing something that is indeed more like people were doing a long time ago, but shod runners are potentially running a different way as well.
Well, there's also a lot of, I guess, debate about running on the whole. So there's this idea of sprints versus long distance or endurance running. So maybe explain the argument.
Yeah, so the argument is that marathons seem like they're really unnatural, because why would you ever run 26 miles, in one fell swoop? To which several biologists respond, well, you might run long distances, in fact, as a part of hunting behavior. And there's something called the persistence running hypothesis that suggests that human beings, they were hunting certainly, and everybody's agreed on that, but they were hunting not by just making some mad dash after a prey animal and then, sticking a spear in it, but literally by running it to exhaustion. So far as there's still some disagreement about this among scientists, and I think, so the final word is not in, but it's at least plausible to suggest that humans could have been running down animals like, say, imagine an ungulate, like a gazelle or, deer or something like that. And because humans are really good at thermoregulation, so we sweat really well, and it means that even in a hot environment, we can manage to keep going, and we can run for much longer periods of time than most other mammals. We can't beat most other mammals in the short run, as it were, but we can do really, really well as long as you let us keep going and going and going, and as long as we can manage to replenish our stores of water or we don't get too exhausted. And so there have been several really fascinating studies of this idea that humans could have evolved running these very long distances as a way to bring down prey, because you're basically just running this animal down until it can't thermoregulate anymore and it just collapses from exhaustion. There's also some intriguing evidence. If you look at our skeletons and you look at our skeletons next to that of, say, a chimpanzee or one of our other ape relatives, we have some really unusual manifestations of the way our necks sit on our shoulders and our heads sit on our necks that seem at least like they compensate for the way we would move, not while walking, but while running.
This is the issue, though. How do we figure out I guess, where the evidence lies. As you said with the last example, you look for data. So what would you, how would you look at this?
So what I like are studies where you can look at this from a bunch of different angles. So one of the things that I found really interesting about looking at both barefoot running and the persistence hunting hypothesis is that you can look at this from a bunch of different ways. You can find people who still do persistence hunting, and there have been a couple of efforts to do that, and you follow them and you ask them questions and you see how they do it. You can look at skeletal evidence and say, well, what does our skeleton look like, and what would it look like if we were more adapted for a different kinds of locomotion? You can look at the gaits of runners from places where they grew up wearing shoes, where they grew up not wearing shoes, where they grew up and then started to put on shoes at, you know, a later date and so forth. And so I think that's the way science progresses best, is by putting together evidence from a number of different sources and looking for continued support or from support from somewhat different angles. And I think this is a really powerful way to try and test some of these ideas. People sometimes say that, oh, well, you know, evolution all happened in the past, and so you can never really know what happened, and so any story we make up is as good as any other. But that's not true at all.
Well, then looking at all the research together, what does that tell us about whether we evolved to run, or the best way to run now?
So I was certainly convinced by the persistence hunting hypothesis. I'm convinced by the skeletal evidence. To me, it doesn't seem like there's any reason to tell people, oh, no, you should really only be sprinting, because sprinting is really the only thing our ancestors were doing. But even the most ardent fans of barefoot running, I don't think that every single human being should be running a marathon every year or every month or however often you can run marathons. I mean, the fact that some people did it in the past and that our skeletons seem to be suited for moving in that fashion still doesn't dictate a certain way that everybody has to be moving. One of the things that always comes out of an examination, both of fossils and of current or contemporary foraging peoples, is that there's a lot of variation out there, and, you know, people do a lot of different things. What is pretty darn obvious is that we really should be moving some. A very sedentary life has demonstrably bad effects on our cardiovascular system and on our muscles and on our ability to regulate insulin and a whole variety of other health issues. But that's not dictating, okay, it's marathons or nothing. I don't think anybody's suggesting that.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with the author of Paleo Fantasy, Marlene Zook. Now, I think one of the most obvious areas, and maybe that's just the way it's presented in the media, but the idea that people say rests on an understanding of the lives of our ancestors is sex and love. So according to evolution, it is all about reproduction. Do you take issue with that?
No, it's totally about reproduction. It's just after that part, you know, things tend to go awry. I'm with you. It is all about reproduction, or it's about reproduction in the sense of it's all about leaving your genes. So no, we're good about that.
Well, maybe give us a brief lesson on reproduction and evolution.
Where it starts to go awry is when people start thinking that modern sex roles are therefore dictated by evolution, or that there's only one way for sex and love to happen. And I think with our ancestors, there's a lot of joking and maybe not so joking references to, well, of course, back in the caveman days, males were always dominant, and men were always selected to spread their seed. And so therefore, monogamy is really this artificial thing that's been slammed onto our modern lives, and that, you know, we are really naturally polygamous. Although I will point out that when people say that, they're almost always really thinking that men are the ones that are supposed to be seeking all these multiple sexual partners,
right?
Whereas women are the ones that are supposed to be naturally monogamous. And every time a prominent politician is, you know, caught having an affair with a younger woman, someone will trot out the, oh, but it's in their genes argument, because, you know, evolution has produced this in us. And, you know, if we want powerful men, then of course we're going to end up with men that also want to stray from their partners. So I think that's the paleo fantasy there.
So how would we look at that from an evidence-based angle?
People tend to forget what I sometimes refer to as the F word. And no, I don't mean that F word, because, well, I mean, people do sometimes, but no, that's not the F word I mean. The F word that I mean is fitness, which gets back to what exactly you said, that evolution is all about reproduction. But reproduction doesn't just mean having sex. It means leaving copies of yourself in future generations. And the only way you can do that if you're a person is by having babies and ensuring that they survive. Human babies, it turns out, are really difficult to raise, and they take a lot of investment. mostly one parent can't do that very successfully by herself. So in humans, as in other animals where the young take a lot of care, evolution actually acts to have both parents invest in the offspring. And so a system like, I don't know, peacocks, where males and females mate and then the females go off, lay their eggs, and, you know, raise the babies all by themselves, is just not going to, it's just not going to work for humans because human babies take too much care. Having sex with a whole bunch of women and then having them not be able to raise the offspring is just as bad as not having sex at all. I mean, it may not seem as bad from, you know, kind of approximate perspective, but from an evolutionary perspective, it is. What that means is that if human beings had a system where males didn't invest in the offspring, then we wouldn't be able to raise babies. Now, certainly there are different ways to invest in the offspring. You can do it by hanging around and changing diapers, or you can do it by providing resources like, you know, food and money and stuff like that. But the bottom line really is that there's no reason to imagine that monogamy is unusual or completely foreign to human beings, because our babies seem to demand an awful lot of investment from us.
What about the concept that gender roles are a cultural universal and therefore they're likely to be adaptive?
The question of cultural universals is a really sticky one. I you know, everybody's really fascinated by this idea that human beings are human beings the world over. And of course, that's true. You know, you can travel to all kinds of parts of the world and you see people doing things that you feel like your next door neighbor could do, or, you know, something like that. And so there's always been this interest in so-called human universals. The problem is that beyond a few really, really broad generalizations, it gets hard to do that. So sure, taking care of your babies and being aware of your relatives are pretty much human universals. That's true for just about every society that anybody's ever studied. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we're going to have one kind of mating system that's going to work, or the idea that we're going to have one way of interacting that's going to work, doesn't really seem to be borne out. And people seem to get really concerned about this when it comes to gender roles, when they don't seem to get concerned about it when it comes to other things. So, you know, it's the idea that we have plumbing and ways to deal with our sewage is something that no one was doing a long time ago, and yet no one seems to be fretting about it. That, you know, this is really awful because, you know, these are not paleo toilets. So there's lots of things that we do differently culturally that I think are a good thing, and we've adapted to them, and we like them, and we're happy with them, and there's no reason why that couldn't apply to other areas of life as well.
Well, there is a lot of discussion about primate studies and how they relate to human sex and love, specifically in regards to chimps and bonobos, correct?
Yeah, so chimps and bonobos, of course, are our two closest primate relatives. And bonobos used to be called pygmy chimpanzees because they look a lot like them, but in fact, they're their own species. And they have, so that's, it's a perfect example of how evolution produces lots and lots of different solutions to the same problem. So the problem's always the same. It's always leaving your genes in the next generation. But there are lots and lots of ways to do that. Bonobos do it with a lot of sex. In a bonobo society, social tensions are often settled by individuals engaging in some form of sexual activity with each other. And that can be between members of the same sex or members of the opposite sex, or among juveniles and so forth. Chimpanzees, on the other hand, seem to have a rather more rigid dominance hierarchy. There's a little bit more fighting and what you might call violence among chimpanzees. They settle things with warfare. There's, you know, people who think that that non-humans never kill each other when they're fighting are wrong, and a good place to look for that is in chimpanzees who do kill each other in battles between groups. So bonobos and chimpanzees are really different in terms of their sex lives. Females are a lot more dominant and apparent in society in bonobos than they are in chimpanzees. Some people have argued that if we'd sort of discovered bonobos first, we would have a much more pacific and kind of free love idea about the way our own sexuality evolved. But because we discovered chimpanzees first and looked at their sex lives, which do have a lot more male dominance and aggression involved, we think that that's the way it must have been. But the real lesson is not, well, we should substitute one for the other because we think bonobos are more PC. It's that, well, like I said, there's a lot of different solutions to exactly the same problem. And so there's no reason to assume that a particular kind of sex role is the way it always was.
So if I can paraphrase, this is all very complicated, is what you're saying.
You know, it is. And I always feel kind of sheepish when people get that conclusion. But it's because you'd never get a headline that says, you know, newsflash, scientists have decided that stuff is really complicated. honestly, that's what we end up concluding. I used to joke with my students that, you know, if they were ever at a loss for how to answer a question that someone asked them when they gave a talk at a scientific conference, they would always be right if they just said, that's a really good question, and it depends. I know that that ends up sounding kind of facile, you know, like you're trying to get out of taking a stand, but, you know, it's really complicated.
I don't think that people say, I don't know enough, personally.
Well, yeah, and that's part of it, or at least that it's variable and the different variants are all equally legitimate.
Right.
So, and I think that that's what comes up with a lot of the food idea is that, you know, seriously, there probably were a lot of different diets for a lot of different lengths of time, and they all worked with some costs and some benefits, and, well, there were good points and bad points. But I don't know what it, maybe, you know, it's modern Western society. We want there to be a winner. You know, we want there to be a like a face-off. And then, you know, we're going to come up with who did this the best. And evolution is just not like that. There's all this jury-rigged stuff happening, whether it's in your body or what's going on in the environment or you know, so forth. And there's the quote that I always like to give is from a biologist from the 20th century, Francois Jacob, who said, well, you know, nature is and evolution is a tinkerer and not an engineer. And so the point being that an engineer starts with a plan and says, I'm going to get to here. I'm going to build this bridge. I need the best materials. I'm going to get those materials. I'm going to use them in the best way possible. And I'm going to build this bridge. But the tinkerer just has a bunch of stuff lying around the garage and says, well, you know, I could probably use this can. And if I attached it to this piece of tubing, I might end up with a still. That's more how evolution works.
Marlene, it was wonderful to have you here.
Great talking to you.
You can find Marlene Zuck and her book, Paleo Fantasy, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. We've been talking a lot about the past today, so let's round it out with a look at what's to come. After the break, guest host Rochelle Saunders will sit down with Kurt Van Mensvoort to talk about the future of meat. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're learning about the brain and the fascinating and devastating things that can happen when its functions are disrupted. We'll speak with journalist Susanna Cahalan about her best-selling memoir, Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. And we're joined by Dr. Rob Tarswell to talk about neurological disorders that mimic psychiatric conditions. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm joined by Kurt Van Mensvoort, an artist, philosopher, and scientist who aims to better understand our co-evolutionary relationship with technology and how it might benefit both humans and the planet. He is the director of the Next Nature Foundation in Amsterdam and Next Nature Lab at Eindhoven University of Technology. Hi, Kurt. Great to have you here.
Yes, thank you.
So can we just start out by agreeing that the future of meat is very weird? I mean, it's wonderful, but it's also really weird.
Yes, it might be very weird. The way we produce meat is going to change in the future. That's something I'm really 100% certain of, because if the world population increases and we will have 9 billion people in 30 years on the planet, they will all want to eat meat. And the way we produce meat today, it's just not going to be sustainable. So it will change. We could all become vegetarians and eat rice and beans. The other option is to eat more insects. And the third option, and that's what I am working on, is to create meat without growing the whole animal. And that might indeed be very weird.
So we've been hearing a lot about 3D printers lately, and it looks like they're actually starting to be used to create food.
Yes, that's one scenario that's also being explored now, that if you have a 3D printer, then you can print a lot of things. And I think the dream of the food printer is already very old, but now it's also becoming more real with first experiments of printing cells. and that can be used for human tissue, replacing tissue of people, like tissue for people who were in a fire and don't have a skin anymore. Then you should think of organs, because that's another field where it can be applied. It's just wonderful if science can help these people to grow new tissue, but it's very similar to growing meat for consumption.
So how do these 3D printers work?
Basically, they print cells. You should compare it to an inkjet printer. A lot of people have an inkjet printer and they print little droplets of paint. And with these printers, cells will be printed. And well, by printing them and they connect to each other, you will grow a tissue. It's really not that difficult, although it is very difficult to produce, because obviously it's something different than when you are printing with ink than when you are printing with cells. That's really a different story. So that's very difficult.
So have we actually been able to print out any food yet from one of these printers?
Not in my lab, but others have made small pieces. And another scenario of creating in vitro meat is by growing it. So some scientists are printing it, others are growing it. And that means they put some cells in a bioreactor, they add substances that feed these cells, and then they can grow by themselves. And in Eindhoven, the work is being done on not printing, but growing the meat. Right now, there are little pieces that can be made.
So we've mentioned in vitro meat a couple of times. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Basically, the idea of in vitro meat is to create meat without growing the whole animal. Over 50 years ago, Winston Churchill said, "Why is it that we grow whole chicken and then in the end only eat the chicken wings?" So that idea is very old. But yeah, it's now becoming a little bit more of a reality, although I must add that it's still to be projected in the future. It's basically taking cells of animals and then creating a situation in which these cells can propagate and grow without a living animal. And that might be more sustainable because you need less energy to do it. And obviously, it's also more animal-friendly because you're not killing an animal for the meat. You just take a few cells from the animal and then the animal can go on and be happy.
So how far has your lab actually gone in creating this kind of, I'm just going to call it vat meat?
Colleagues of mine, they are engineering the meat. They create pieces of meat which are smaller than a centimeter, so really quite small. And there's one professor now in the Netherlands who says, "Okay, I'm going to make a hamburger out of that, and I'm going to present that hamburger this year." That will cost, I think, €200,000 to create one hamburger.
Oh, that's an expensive hamburger.
Yes, that's a very expensive hamburger.
Who gets to eat it?
The idea is that some famous person of who the name is not yet revealed will get to eat it. In my lab, we more focus not so much on creating these pieces, but answering the design question. What kind of products will come out of this? Well, it's obvious that the first thing you make is a hamburger, but in the end, these new technologies will also lead to whole new products and perhaps even eating habits or food cultures, as we call them. We envision some potential future meat products, which is then much more speculative. One product is the instant meat powder. So the basic assumption is, we can produce meat, but we cannot really produce meat with a structure like a steak. We can only produce this powder, and it has the proteins of the meat, but it will look and feel very different. More advanced scenarios are that we can produce meat, but only threads of meat. And then we would find a way to knit this meat into a bigger structure. So then you might have a hamburger or a steak that's knitted from these meat threads. Even one step further is the idea that as you are creating artificial meat, well, you might also find hybrids between different products, and the meat fruit is an example of that.
Meat fruit?
Yes, but that assumes that you can engineer it. Then the assumption is that you might get hybrids between meat and fruit, because we're engineering all these things on the lowest level, so then you can make meat fruit, and that sounds weird, although it might be presented as an amuse before a dish. And what's also interesting about it is that there's this little feminist layer in it, because 40,000 years ago, when we were on the savannah, the idea was that the male would hunt and get the meat, whereas the women would gather the fruit. But of course, we're all evolved much further now, and this also is represented in this meat fruit product. If you see the visualizations, it also looks a lot like fruit, but it has the structure of meat. Well, for most people, that just sounds like odd and off. But if you taste it and you have this experience of a hybrid between fruit and meat, then you learn that it might just taste wonderful and that it's an exquisite experience. And of course, you need technology to do it. But then if you look at a nice, well-prepared wine, there's also a lot of technology needed to turn the grapes into this nice, wonderful wine. It's just that those technologies, they are older. We already know them. We're more familiar with it. And that's why we can appreciate the wine. But maybe someone from the Stone Age would think a wine was very weird and different and artificial and would maybe not even drink it. So the same could happen with this new way of producing meat. Of course, I'm speculating now because this is projecting towards the future. But I think it's an interesting future to explore and to embrace.
So you guys are actually sort of gaming out the potential future of what the technology is trying to do.
Yes. We're trying to visualize what the technology in the end might bring us. And we try to visualize it in a way that what you see is an everyday product. Because if you talk about it, and now we're talking about it on the radio, so it may sound abstract. What is this artificial meat? And what is it? I'm not going to eat it, a lot of people might think. But as you make the visualizations of the potential products, it becomes much more tangible.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to philosopher, artist, and scientist Kurt van Mensvoort about the future of meat. So we talked a little bit about how a lot of this is very speculative, and right now, you know, the labs are very much engaged in creating these small pieces of meat, kind of in test scenarios. But it sounds like, you know, the technology really isn't going to be sort of growing us steaks that we can sort of buy the way we do now. It sounds like the future of meat is actually going to potentially look very different than it looks today.
Yeah, I think it will certainly look different. That's for sure, because every new technology also evolves into new products. And people typically don't realize that at the moment a technology is introduced. If you think of the first cars, they were called horseless carriages. In the end, the car turned out to be something quite different than a horse and a carriage. But at first, people just thought, hey, that's handy. I have a carriage and I don't need a horse anymore. And the same will happen with meat, I think. Another question which is, I think, interesting is the question, who's going to produce it? Because the industries that are creating the meat today, that are producing the meat that we buy in the supermarkets and find on our dishes, it's not sure whether they are going to do it. I'm really not certain about that. And that's also similar to, if you think about solar energy that is not pushed by the oil industry, or online publishing is also not rolled out by the newspaper industry. So it might be that with in vitro meat, there will also be opportunities for different companies to step in. I think a lot of people think in vitro meat, it's very artificial and technological. It must be this technology push from companies, but I think it's not the case. So there's not that much investment from industry right now in this new potential of meat. But I do sense that there's also a big societal interest in it, because a lot of people feel that the way that meat is produced today has become a bit weird because we buy these meat products in the supermarket, but we don't know the animals where they are made from. We don't see them. We've become kind of detached from them. And there's also an uncanniness already there today. And that might be solved, or it might change with these different kind of meat products.
There does seem to be a lot of opposition to in vitro meat. Is it mainly the sort of yuck factor, or are there actually some good reasons for people to be concerned about this technology?
Well, I think there are way more benefits than drawbacks. And the biggest drawback that people experience is that the yuck factor, I'm not going to eat something from a lab. That's really quite a strong visceral experience that people have. Although, as I see it, it's also a bit odd because they say, yuck, I'm not going to eat in vitro meat. And then they walk into a supermarket and buy square cubes of chicken meat, which in a way is also very processed and artificial. So to me, that's not the most convincing argument. I think there are lots of benefits. It's just that it's still very, very difficult and expensive to produce it. But then again, the meat as we produce it today, that will also probably become more expensive, if only for sustainability reasons.
So you mentioned sustainability, and it sounds like there are a lot of advantages of in vitro meat, including that it may be more environmentally beneficial than the way we currently go about getting our meat.
Yes, I think the two biggest advantages are the promise that it could be more sustainable, and the other advantage is that it's definitely more animal friendly. And there are, of course, also still competing scenarios, because yes, indeed, we can all be vegetarians. Or we could eat more insects, which is also a good protein source. Although obviously there's for many people, at least in the Western world, also a yuck factor there.
So you actually mentioned eating insects a couple of times. And mm-hmm. If people don't like the idea of meat grown in vats, they probably definitely won't like the idea of eating insects. If I were to say to you, Kurt, why would I want to eat bugs when I have this tasty hamburger right here? What would you say? How do you talk someone into that?
Well, maybe it's not urgent enough at this moment, and you can still eat your hamburger, because right now people can buy a hamburger at a very low price. And if you close your eyes for the industry and the way the animals are treated, then you can just happily eat your hamburger. But that might become more expensive. You see this in developing regions in the world. Once people start to earn more money, they also start to eat more meat. But it might be difficult to maintain that production at this low cost.
So finally, is it the technology or the regulation or the potential customer pool that's slowing down this end meatening process? Because talking to our regular host, Desiree, she's been waiting a long time for all of these technologies, and she wants to know who to blame for not having them yet.
Well, I think the big bottleneck is that it is indeed technically very difficult to produce. The other bottleneck is that also when we talk about it, we are still a little bit reluctant. Whereas I also feel, on the one hand, I feel a big societal urge to change the way we produce meat, if only for the lack of animal friendliness in it. But most people, they want to go back to the past. And yeah, what past you want to go back to? Do you want to slaughter your own animal? Probably not. But I think it's also interesting to go forward and to explore these other scenarios. But we are reluctant there. And I think we should learn to love the future also a little bit more and embrace the artificiality of it. Because typically in our society, artificial things are seen as inferior derivatives. And they're also presented as inferior derivatives. But they might also gain a certain authenticity of their own. And that's what I'm hoping for with the in vitro meat. So I hope in the end it will not be this inferior derivative of a hamburger, which in itself already is not the most top-notch meat product. But that instead it could create new food cultures, new eating experiences that we do not know today, but might embrace in the future. And that's still a long way ahead, but we can get there, I think.
Kurt, great to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be there.
You can find a link to Kurt van Mensvoort and his work on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you might like to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so you can stay up to date on show news. Or maybe click on over to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.